Government moves pretty slowly, and yet six lawmakers declared a budget impasse one day and then helped approve the plan the next. One of the big sticking points, charter schools.
It is addressing needs, our growth, addressing the needs of offering more to our students, and then looking for a funding source to be able to make that happen.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, cutting through the budget talks. Also, One Phoenix Park is looking east for some reinvention inspiration, and Scottsdale wants a piece of another.
How Arizona hospitals are doing in preventing their patients from getting infections, and we visit another of the Valley's hot corners.
They have so much great building stock here. It is truly a walkable area. These sidewalks are covered, they're shaded, and they're populated with all kinds of great little businesses.
Plus, new Valley music, old Valley music, and a Valley music festival.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Looks like a pretty nice rest of your day for today. Nice weekend as well. Look for a high today of 80 degrees up to the mid-80s over the weekend. One quick traffic note to pass along. There's an accident blocking the shoulder on the 60 westbound at Mill.
Voting rights groups are appealing a judge's decision that requires federal election officials to help Arizona and Kansas enforce state laws requiring new voters to document their U.S. citizenship. A court filing today sent to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals seeks review of this month's ruling by a federal judge in Kansas who ordered the U.S. Election Assistance Commission to immediately modify a national voter registration form to add special instructions requiring proof of citizenship for Kansas and Arizona residents. More than a dozen voting rights groups and other people made the appeal.
The lesser prairie chicken has officially been listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the listing could impact the Southwest oil and gas industry.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says rapid population decline was behind the decision to list the bird as threatened. The lesser prairie chicken is a small bird that lives in grasslands across the West. It had some protections by conservation efforts run in individual states. Steve Hinke is the president of the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association. He says the listing has the potential to limit drilling on some oil and gas fields and could put the matter up to legal interpretation in federal courts.
Well, I don't think that's good news for the industry. We're disappointed in the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision. I think it's fair to say that it's going to create difficulty.
Environmentalists are praising the decision, but have also expressed disappointment, arguing the bird should have seen a more comprehensive endangered listing. At last count, an estimated 17,500 birds remain in the wild. Carrie Young, KJZZ News.
There's nothing like watching the sunrise from the state capitol. I can say that because I've done it before.
With a beard.
Yes. It wasn't quite that late last night, but the Arizona House worked well into the evening to approve a new state budget. That after six GOP lawmakers had declared talks on the plan at an impasse just the day before. Joining us out on the ledge this afternoon, we welcome Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services to help us sort out what happened and what happens next. Hi, Howie.
Good morning, good afternoon. What time is it?
Yeah,
I can't stand these all-nighters.
You've been up a long time now. So what ultimately broke the impasse?
Well, it kind of came down to getting a little bit of money and a kiss and a promise. The money is about $54 million. About $33 million of that has to do with charter schools and funding, and we can talk about that in a minute. What they also got is some nickels and dimes here and there. For example, $2.5 million for a U of A vet school, $900,000 to help for private prison costs. And then they got a verbal commitment, or actually a written commitment, if you will, that while we're not adding any more money beyond the Senate plan to Child Protective Services, or really the new Department of Child Safety and Family Services, we promise to look at it again. And that seemed to satisfy a lot of the lawmakers. I mean, their belief was, if you're going to fix CPS, you can't do it with just the money you've got. And the Senate came up with a little extra money, but nowhere near what the governor wanted. I mean, we're talking, $7, $8 million difference there, and that has a lot of staff. The argument by Senate President Andy Biggs had been, well, we're still studying it, and so we'll do something. Well, that promise wasn't enough, so the language in the Kate Brophy McGee amendment says we've got this commitment to, quote, re-examine this budget. That seems to satisfy enough House members. Most of the six jumped back on board. Ethan Orr did not. There's some political reasons for that. But that broke the logjam. I mean, they needed 31, and they end up with 33.
Howie, some Democrats, Katie Hobbs in particular, were critical of this deal and even said, wow, why did you waste our time when you really didn't get much? Does it seem like they didn't get much considering the press conference they held, this big deal, and then 24 hours later, things advanced?
Well, you're assuming there was a lot to get.
I'm always assuming
becomes,
that.
Howie. Well, the problem becomes, whose revenue figures do you accept? The governor has obviously much more generous revenue figures. I think the Democrats would have rather had her budget. Heck, the Democrats would have rather added another $1 billion onto it based on their idea that we can balance the budget with some revenue enhancements and closing tax loopholes. But given the revenue figures that the legislature accepted, there was only so much you could do. And so you had to decide what you're willing to do and how much you're willing to hold out for. I think that one of the purposes of having six members literally come over here to the legislative press room was to get the attention of leadership. And it clearly did, because originally, I think House Speaker Andy Tobin said, I'll just put it up. If they want to vote yes, they'll vote yes, they'll vote no, and then they have to live with the political consequences. But it certainly brought the issue to the fore, and it probably provided them with the leverage they need. And what it also provided Andy Tobin with as House Speaker is the ability to go back to his more conservative members and say, look, I need to add some money to the budget. It doesn't have to be a lot, but if we don't, they may go and work with the Democrats. And if you think this budget is expensive, where do you see what they come up with the Dems?
And Howie, very briefly, give us a quick update on what happened with the proposal allowing school districts to convert their schools to charters. That was very controversial.
Very controversial. Several school districts had figured out that charter schools get about $1,000 extra per student. And the reason has been charters are generally privately run, some for profit, some not for profit, but they don't have access to things like bonding and local taxes. Public schools have gone ahead and formed these, so they're getting their extra money, and they're getting, obviously, access to tax revenues, and it's at a cost of about $33 million a year right now. Senate President Andy Biggs said, you know, if we don't close this loophole, we're going to be at $100 million a year. We're going to bust the budget. So what they did is say, look, we will continue the $33 million for one more year, and then we will form a committee to decide what needs to happen next to charter schools, probably with the idea that if you have a public school system running a charter school, we will go ahead and force them to make the choice. Either you make it a traditional public school and lose the $1,000, or if you want the extra $1,000, then it has to be divorced entirely, so you're not also getting the local tax revenues.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Very welcome.
As Howie just mentioned, charter school conversions were a major sticking point during this week's budget talks. Last year, districts around the state converted about 60 schools to charters, and the budget approved by the House last night will allow those schools to keep operating. That's good news for Kevin Hegarty. He's the CFO of the Higley Unified School District, which built two middle schools, made them charters, and leased them through a private foundation.
We needed to address the issue of our population, number one, and number two, we wanted to give more options for our students. And all of our schools, elementary schools, were K-8, plus we had two high schools. So when we built two new schools, we made them middle schools. So now we've set ourselves up for a middle school setting for our students, which has never been in this district before. They have more options. They have more of a STEM program. And we also implemented a one-to-one iPad program. We chartered our two new schools. Now, in that lease arrangement, since we had no help from the state, the additional assistance we get from the charter funding is exactly what other charter schools that are the for-profit charter schools do instead of district-sponsored. They do use that additional assistance to help pay for their infrastructure. So the money we're getting from the charter formula is going to pay the lease on those new buildings.
So it sounds like your decision to add charter schools to your district was not really done out of a need for more money.
Well, it was not. You got to look at the primary motivator, because it's not a yes or no answer. It is addressing needs, our growth, addressing the needs of offering more to our students, and then looking for a funding source to be able to make that happen.
Would you have been able to build those two new schools without using the charter method?
Yes, we could have. The issue then becomes you have to give up other things to get that. And I hate to use the word, but the reality of it is you would have to cannibalize your existing budget. Not to say we wouldn't do that. We would. But this gave us the opportunity to address those needs while having to go back and do, you know, and make other reductions in order to support the construction of the new schools.
So what do you make of the arguments that some critics of this practice make, which is basically districts aren't really offering anything different in their charter schools as opposed to their traditional schools? They're really just doing it to make money.
You know, I'm having a difficult time with it because I can't speak for other districts. Let me start with that. I do know that there's been a lot of innovation. I've heard some of the other discussions that were going on from other districts about what they are doing, and they all sound really good. You know, the charter schools were meant to create competition. Then this model that they've developed is going directly to the heart of why charters were formed in the first place.
Kevin Haggerty is the chief financial officer for the Higley Unified School District. He mentioned some charter school programs and districts are innovative. Jonathan Butcher agrees. He's the education director at the Goldwater Institute.
It's not the act of converting a school that's necessarily a bad thing. I think the issue is that in the past year or so, it's been somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 schools that have been suddenly converted. And so there is no mechanism that I know of in law right now that would help us to make sure that all of these schools are in fact doing something innovative and different and providing new choices the way that charter schools should.
So the fact that some of these districts have been pretty open about the fact that they're doing this in a way to get a little bit more money for their districts, I would imagine that's something that you're not okay with.
Well, yes, I don't think that was the idea behind charter school. You know, I think that we want schools that are going to provide innovative programs and new choices and operate with, you know, less with more flexibility, right? With greater flexibility than what's in the traditional system in exchange for higher levels of accountability.
So I guess in the end, are you okay with this practice of school districts either converting some of their traditional schools into charter schools or just operating charter schools?
I don't think that we should restrict the ability of districts to convert schools to charter schools. I think it's the details of how they do so that matter, right? I think what's going to matter is they need to have an independent board, because when districts convert a school, that school is typically still subject to the district school board. And a critical feature of charter schools is that they have an independent leadership team. And then I also think that there have to be things in the law that make it so that these charter schools that have been converted from district schools have a similar set of accountability provisions, right? We need to be ready to close them down if they fail. We need to have regular reviews of how they are performing, just like we do with charter schools authorized by the state charter school board, right? We need to put those things in place so that we can make sure that these schools are in fact doing what charter schools were designed to do.
Jonathan Butcher is the education director at the Goldwater Institute.
Still to come, reimagining a central Phoenix park with big aspirations.
This is a unique opportunity to have 32 acres in the fifth or sixth largest city in the United States in downtown. This can be our Central Park, or if you're from Chicago, our Millennium Park.
That's ahead. It's the show. Back for a warm weekend around the valley. Got a couple of days of respite below normal temperatures. That'll change again this weekend. We'll have partly to mostly sunny skies with high temperatures both Saturday and Sunday, around 85 degrees. Currently around the valley, relative humidity is at 17%. It's mostly sunny and 75 degrees. And a quick check of valley traffic in the East Valley. There's an accident on the 60 westbound at Mill. It's blocking the shoulder.
KJZZ is supported by the CORE Institute, fellowship-trained orthopedic physicians helping patients keep life in motion. Offices valley-wide. TheCoreInstitute.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody.
Two oil giants are sitting down in Riyadh today. One of them, of course, Saudi Arabia, but the other leader of an oil giant is the Emir of Washington, D.C., Barack Obama, President of the United States, which is importing less oil from Saudi Arabia today than at any time over the past two decades. And that's just one interesting fact that makes this U.S.-Saudi encounter particularly interesting. Joining us is Robert Worth, contributor to the New York Times Magazine, former Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times. Robert, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
What is changing in this relationship? I know you're writing a book about the consequences of the Arab Spring. It seems that on the face of it, the changing energy situation that I alluded to and the Arab Spring have really put Saudi Arabia on the defensive right now.
That's true. And I think primarily what President Obama wants to do is reassure the Saudis that the fundamentals of the relationship have not changed. The Saudis have been anxious for a long time because they, as they see it, the Iraq war basically handed Iraq to Iran and changed the balance of power for them. And what's happened over the past couple of years has only made it worse. As you mentioned, you know, the U.S. has become somewhat more independent energy-wise. But for the Saudis, the big threat is Iran. It's always been this great rival for them, Iran being the great Shia power and the Saudis being the Sunni power. And they see Syria as a battlefield in which Iran is really threatening them.
Let's talk about some common ground here. Is there any common ground as far as the oil markets are concerned right now between Saudi Arabia and the United States? And what about cooperation in Yemen against al-Qaeda? That was traditionally a very, very warm sort of common ground zone for the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
On counterterrorism, for the most part, they're still on the same page. And in terms of oil, you know, the fundamentals of the relationship have always been that the Saudis provide consistent free-flowing supply of oil, and the Americans provide a security guarantee for the region. And Yemen has become increasingly important there. It's right next to Saudi Arabia. They have, in the past, the Yemenis have always feared that the Saudis were happy with chaos in Yemen. But now that's become much more of a direct threat because you have an al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen that is the most active of all the affiliates outside of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that consists mostly of Saudi, or to a large extent, of Saudi nationals who are determined to strike at Saudi Arabia. So there is a lot of cooperation between the Americans and the Saudis on that.
So looking west in Egypt, General al-Sisi, not as a general, is going to run for president in Egypt. Does that make the Saudis happy? And do you think Egypt comes up in these discussions? Where does it sort of sit in the food chain of issues between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely. That's another big issue for the Saudis. The Saudis recently declared the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist group like al-Qaeda. And for the Saudis, another source of anger is they feel that the Americans have stood against them on this issue. The Americans supported Morsi insofar as Mohamed Morsi was the elected president of Egypt. And they were upset when there was a coup last June when General Sisi and the military overthrew Morsi. Morsi, of course, quickly became the favorite candidate to be the next leader of Egypt. This was a violation of the democratic process. The Americans, of course, say that they're not favoring the Muslim Brotherhood any more than any other group, but they can't abide this kind of violation of basic democracy. And to the Saudis, the Muslim Brotherhood is a really serious threat. They were delighted with the overthrow of Morsi, and they're angry that the Americans aren't more supportive about that.
And if we're talking about the leadership in Saudi Arabia before we go, I would suspect that given the issues that you've outlined here, there may be some incentive for the Saudi leadership to really think beyond Barack Obama to who occupies the White House next in 2016.
Yes, absolutely. They're not comfortable with Obama. They feel that he doesn't really I think it's two things. It's partly sort of a more a basic issue that they feel he doesn't side with them on issues relating to Iran, the Muslim Brotherhood. They feel that if there's a deal cut with the Iranians on the nuclear issue, that they will somehow pay the price for that by allowing the U.S. will allow Iran to be more active in places like Lebanon and Syria. And it's also partly personal. They feel that Obama has not paid them the kind of respect just in terms of public gestures that they would like. And I think that's a big part of this trip. Obama wants to reassure them, to sort of to show them that he respects them, to have a face-to-face greeting. And so that should help. Mm. But absolutely, they would love to see somebody different.
All right. Robert Wirth, contributor to the New York Times Magazine, former Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times on the ingredients for an awkward meeting, a testy meeting, full of anxiety there in Saudi Arabia between Barack Obama and the leadership of Saudi Arabia. Robert, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Does it sound possible that Phoenix will be the home of a place that could compare to New York's Central Park or Chicago's Millennium Park? With last night's official unveiling of the new master plan for Hants Park downtown, the initial steps are being taken. The nearly $120 million proposal includes a performance facility, water features, exercise paths, and a restaurant, among other things. Hans Park is just off of I-10 at 3rd Street. For now, it includes the Irish Cultural Center, the Japanese Friendship Garden, and a large green belt where I met Tim Sprague, president of the Hans Park Conservancy.
We're standing at the southeast corner of Hans Park, located at 3rd Street and Moreland, and we are looking northwest at the beautiful Phoenix Central Library that was designed by the famous Will Bruder.
When we're thinking about changes to Hans Park, first of all, let's talk about what Hans Park has been for the past couple of decades. Has it been a place that people care about, that people know about? What needs to change?
Well, Hans Park originally was commemorated or really began the finished product in 1992. It was a mitigation by the federal government for putting the I-10 freeway through the middle of a very historic neighborhood. Over 220 historic homes were demolished to have the freeway come through. So there was a series of 19 bridges that were erected to connect the neighborhood, to piece it back together, if you will. And Hans Park is on top of those 19 bridges, and I-10 runs underneath it. It's gone through a series of changes. The first and biggest one is that the very spectacular design for the park was only about 20% completed. 1992 went on, city ran out of money, federal government didn't put any more money into the program, and you ended up with a very nice green space, but all of the nice accoutrements that were designed into the park were never developed.
How excited are you? How excited should we be about what this park can be?
Well, I think probably the most exciting thing is that this is a unique opportunity to have 32 acres in the fifth or sixth largest city in the United States in downtown with the opportunity to have, in essence, a blank slate to come in and redesign a park. This can be our Central Park, or if you're from Chicago, our Millennium Park.
What is a great park, a Central Park, a Millennium Park, a Hans Park? What does it need to really represent the community and be a place people want to come?
Well, it needs activity. If you could underscore one word, it's activity. And how do you do that? Well, you design amenities within the park that will attract people on a constant basis. You need activity daily. And you also need programming that brings people from the larger area around, not only Phoenix, but outside of the Phoenix metropolitan area, to come to activities. Concerts are a great example.
Okay, Tim, you know there are skeptics. Are you battling certain challenges that you think can be overcome?
If you've ever been to the First Friday Art Walk that takes place in downtown Phoenix, we literally have 14,000 to 16,000 people every month that come downtown to look at art. I have a daughter that's come back to Phoenix, and the first thing she did was come in and see where she could live in downtown Phoenix. She and her husband live in downtown Phoenix. If that conversation took place 15 years ago, there's no way that would have happened. What the opportunity now is get on the train, and the train is coming back to the core. And if you go back and look at what's happened to home prices and where things have recovered quickly and where new restaurants happened during the recession, it wasn't out on the outer lands. It wasn't in very North Scottsdale. It was in the core of the city in downtown Phoenix.
When you think about what you want it to look like to people who've never been to Phoenix before, what should a Hans Park be, and how should it fit what Phoenix is?
Firstly, I would like to see a show of hands of all the people in the city of Phoenix that have ever been to Hans Park. And I bet you're going to find that 99 out of 100 have never been to Hans Park. And they're missing out on one of our real jewels, which is the Japanese Friendship Garden, which is located on the west side of the park. So let's build upon what that is. What should the park look like? Well, number one, it should be engaging and reach out into the neighborhood. The original design didn't do that. It's very difficult to find out where the park is. Most people don't even know when they drive south on Central or north on Central past the library, that the bridge that they drive over, that there's a park on either side of that bridge. You can't even see it. Big change there. We need to change that to make that happen. If you look at the great parks, there are restaurants around the parks. There are all kinds of activities going on. And we have the opportunity with the undeveloped land around this park to make that take place. The Parks Department itself is looking at a couple of buildings that they own around the park to make sure that they're converted into restaurants. Things that people can take advantage of on a daily basis. That activity will cause it to happen to be the signature place for people to come see when they visit Phoenix.
Tim Sprague is president of the Hans Park Conservancy. The master plan is expected to be paid for with public and private money and could take up to 10 years to complete.
A new report from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention looking at infections patients get at hospitals has some mixed results both nationally and in Arizona. The CDC looked at a series of infections, including those from different surgeries and urinary tract infections from catheters. Dr. Michael Bell, Deputy Director of the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the CDC, says those tend to happen to patients who are among the sickest in the hospital in the intensive care unit and are associated with medical devices or procedures.
And we know from a long history of evidence and observation that those two things are strongly tied to infections. And they offer opportunities for improvement.
Bell says the country seems to be doing better in some areas, like infections resulting from central lines, tubes placed in large veins, and some surgeries.
The national picture is that there's a 10 to 20% fewer infections than you would have expected based on previous calculations. That's for the nation overall. The Arizona numbers look like there's 10 to 20% more than you might have expected. What we don't know is where the problem actually lies.
Bell cautions it's very difficult to compare states in the progress report since they all started in different places and need work in different areas. Greg Vigder, president and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association, says there's some good progress being made around the country, and Arizona is involved in some of those efforts.
One infection is one too many. And we're still seeing some problems in Arizona, and we're going to have to keep working on them, and we're committed to doing that in our association.
How big of an issue is this among your member hospitals?
Well, I think quality is one of the things that really drives a lot of the real passion in the field.
Are there particular things that Arizona hospitals have been doing over the past months or years to try to bring some of these numbers down?
We've been doing a number of things over the years, and I think we're just amping up our efforts as a result of reports just like this one. So we've tried to really partner with national organizations and local organizations to figure out how we can work together to make a difference, even across hospitals, trying to make sure everybody understands the best practices, develop local leadership within the hospitals, and really find the best ways forward. Change is hard. That's some of what this is reflecting. But being that it's hard doesn't mean that we don't have to change, and we just have to figure out a way to do that. So a lot of the projects are really developed to figure out how we can sort of find the best ways and move forward. I think one of the big things we are doing is we've been involved with the American Hospital Association in forming what's called a hospital engagement network. And through that, and 31 other state hospital associations are partners in this as well, we're really coming together to partner with our hospitals in different states and really do this as a national effort.
As far as actually trying to reduce the number of some of these kinds of infections, how complicated a task is that?
Well, it's complicated mostly in trying to find the initiative forward. I think all healthcare providers, all hospitals really understand the importance of doing it, but it's just really the making sure the techniques really move forward and the best practices are found and pushed. And so I think it's really just a matter of execution, but it's a complicated world, and it's a complicated clinical setting that we're facing with sicker and sicker patients as well.
Have you found from talking to some of the folks at your member hospitals that doing some of these things are they expensive to try to implement?
Some of them are, and it might be a matter of money, but again, I think the driving force is just how hard change can be, especially in such a chaotic and uncertain environment.
Greg Vigder is president and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Tony Rixby. I'm the public address announcer at the Surprise Recreation Complex.
68 Ryan Fairbed, behind the plate number 61, Robinson Chirinos.
We do a number of informative things before the start of the game. Then during the course of the game, I will announce each batter, all the changes that come in the lineups, as well as reading commercials.
Second baseman number one, Nick Pronto.
I love baseball. It gives me a chance to watch the entire game, be behind the microphone, use words and the power of language. So it's a lot of fun for me, and I love being in Arizona. Most challenging is getting the position changes in. You're also trying to read a commercial and listen to the official score tell you the changes at the same time.
First baseman, number 18, Alberto Ocasio.
It gets a little chaotic at times, but it's a challenge and fun.
Tony Rigsby announcing a game at the Surprise Recreation Complex. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. Batter up.
I can't possibly follow that. Still to come, a local band is releasing a new single today and doing most of the work themselves.
It allows us to experiment as much as we want. Like, as far as the recording process goes, there's no time constraints and no budget constraints. We just go in and try stuff.
Showcasing local bands is part of the Tiny Desert Concerts. That's ahead. It's the show.
Look for clear skies tonight around the valley. We're looking for lows in the lower to mid-50s and then a sunny, warm weekend with highs both Saturday and Sunday around 85 degrees. Currently, relative humidity is at 17%, and we're at 75 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by REDW, CPAs and business and financial advisors serving the financial, tax, and audit needs of businesses and individuals since 1953. Offices in Phoenix and Albuquerque. More information at REDW.com.
This is the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. It's a service that blends everything that makes our world what it is.
I'm John P. Dixon, better known as Johnny D., Arizona's unofficial music historian.
When you think about Arizona music, a few names come to mind right away. Linda Ronstadt, Duane Eddy, Lee Hazelwood, even Alice Cooper, internationally recognized country and rock musicians. But what you may not know is that in the 50s and 60s, Phoenix had an R&B scene. There was soul, doo-wop, and funk, all being recorded here in Arizona. Now Johnny D is releasing a compilation of some of these recordings from a Phoenix label called Ramco. All of the music was recorded at a Phoenix studio audio recorders between 1956 and 71, and almost all of the bands were from Phoenix. So what was the Phoenix music scene like at the time?
South Phoenix had its R&B and soul. The Mexican community, they had their dances and mariachi bands and such. Phoenix would have country. There was just a ton of country groups playing in the clubs around town. Then I must mention also Mama's Little Boy Freddie, who played down at, I think it was called the Washington Street Record Bar, and Freddie played in the window, and he was on from 10 to midnight on KTYL, on the Red Harkins' operation on the Mesa Tempe Highway. And so from what I was told, kids would sit out, and it was a gathering places for all cultures to park out in front and sit there, and there was a speaker on the street. And Freddie Blanco was his name, and he was the one. And this was happening in every city, where suddenly the white kids are hearing this music that they had not been exposed to before, and their parents would not want them to hear.
Did these groups have aspirations in the sense of, hey, I've got a record coming out with a label? Or were these folks working second jobs? Was this just sort of something, hey, I'm good at this, I want to give it a shot? But how realistic could they be based on what the business was like then?
Well, like even today, it's a long shot. But I'd like to think that they all, if they had their druthers, would certainly love to have been on American Bandstand in the day or touring at the Apollo Theater or wherever. But most, at the end of the day, went back to their day jobs. And one of the groups, in fact, we talk about, the Tads, had an opportunity to get out of town. Bumps Blackwell, who was Little Richard's producer and also with Specialty Records in Los Angeles, made them an offer to go on the road with Little Richard. And one guy, I think it was Duke Draper, was the one that wanted to get out of town, and the other three wanted to stay with their day jobs. They just didn't want to take that chance.
You live in me, but I don't know why.
So occasionally you would get the opportunity to say no, but for most of the bands, that opportunity never arrived.
Who was listening to R&B and doo-wop in Phoenix in the mid to late 50s. What was the audience like? Did people know it was there? Did the average white audience know it was there?
No, I would say they probably didn't in the early days, but certainly South Phoenix was much aware. With the record stores down there and club scene, there was a very large local live music scene at night. Lots of clubs along Buckeye and Broadway Road, and some of these groups definitely played down there. And then the other factor that comes in, several of these groups came from like Luke or Williams Air Force Base. They were black airmen or servicemen who would perform in the USO clubs and then come into Phoenix on the weekend and play in the clubs and then, if they were lucky, be seen by someone who said, hey, do you want to make a record?
What's another one that stands out?
Well, probably one of the most popular funk-wise is the first track by Chuck Womack and the Sweet Souls.
Delmo, put on them ham hocks. All right. Don't you burn them now. Bubbasita, put on them beans, baby.
It's called Ham Hocks and Beans, and it's just a great, funky track with Chuck calling out different members of the band, and then they get a little solo, but it's the funk, it's the bass, the interaction between the bass and the drums, and this has made this record, as well as some of the other records, very collectible and worth lots of money.
It's gonna be all right. Ham hocks, red beans.
This is definitely one of the great songs that were recorded here in Phoenix, and it's a great way to kick off the CD.
We've been talking about the new Phoenix R&B compilation, Shaboom Bang, with Johnny D. It's available at azmusicdude.com.
That's what it is. It's soul food. That's what it is.
It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. I'm in a studio that, until a few days ago, frankly, I didn't know existed here at KJZZ. And the reason I'm in this big room is because there are a few people with me, specifically three-fifths of the Valley-based band Of the Painted Choir. The band released a self-titled EP last year and is releasing a new single and music video today. Joining me are Fred Huang, Phil Hanna, and Wayne Jones. Welcome to you all.
Hey.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
So I've read a bunch of descriptions of your music, and I'm curious how you guys describe your own music.
I guess like 60s influenced psychedelic pop.
Okay. If people don't know what that means, what would they think of?
Definitely like Beatles-y, Beach Boys-y, some Motown stuff thrown in there, but also at the same time like a little country and a little Southwestern-y.
So, Fred, you guys have a new single and a new music video coming out, yes?
Yes, we do. The single's called Cactus Wren. It's kind of a love song, kind of dedicated to a bird.
The state bird of Arizona.
The state bird of Arizona. I Googled that to figure that out. But, like, it's kind of a song to a woman, but at the same time, the woman is Arizona. It doesn't make a whole lot of linear sense, but that's the way I wrote it.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay. One, two... 1, 2, 3, 4.
Remedies in my cold, dark hand. I raise my loving words to the bird that I adore. As these old souls roam freely, you know my heart remains rooted down to this ground. Oh, oh, oh. Oh, Cactus Wren, why can't you listen to my words and sing me back a loving? Cactus Wren, ooh, 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 You know my conscience, it knows too well. Oh yes, my conscience knows too well that I'm in hell. Oh cactus man, why can't you listen to my words and sing me back a loving melody? Maybe then we can both depart past the twilight and the morning darkness. Oh my cactus man, oh, oh, oh.
So I can actually kind of imagine that being played on the radio in, like, 1965, which I guess is partially what you're going for, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm an old soul.
So you guys are kind of a DIY kind of band, right? Like, you basically do everything yourselves.
Yeah, that's definitely a mentality that I wanted to bring into this project, was just to record ourselves, book ourselves, print our own medium for music CDs or whatever. And all the guys in the band kind of feel like that's a good plan for us.
Do you all have different skills? Like, is one of you good at graphic design? One of you is really good at, like, cold calling places to try to get yourselves booked, anything like that?
Well, we have our guitar player who's not here with us, Darren. He's an awesome graphic designer, so he does a lot of the design work for us. But we also utilize friends to, like, do art for us, and we'll compensate them however we can, which is usually with, like, a very gracious thank you.
But heartfelt, I'm sure.
Heartfelt, for sure, for most of them.
What's the advantage of doing all this stuff yourself?
It allows us to experiment as much as we want. Like, as far as the recording process goes, there's no time constraints and no budget constraints. We just go in and try stuff, and if things work out really well, which sometimes they do, that's great. And if not, then we wasted a few hours, but ultimately we'll be happier with the final product, in a sense. There's another sense that, like, with a professional producer and engineer, like, the stuff will sound better. But that's part of the challenge for me personally that I really embrace.
So you guys are going to play one more song for us?
Yeah. I don't have a name for this one yet. This is a brand new song, and we're going to be releasing a record in the summer, and the song will be on it. We actually have never played this for anybody than ourselves before. So
this is history.
Yeah. Yeah, very small part of history about to happen right now. One, two, three, four.
Judas have got the best of me. Bags packed in, shoes shine bright, and following my father's dreams to me. Well, some things just can't be taught to man like me.
Fred Huang, Phil Hanna, and Wayne Jones are 3/5 of the Valley-based band Of the Painted Choir. They're releasing a new single and music video today. And if you're in a band or know of one we should be talking to, send us your music, the show, at kjzz.org.
There's disease in my hereditary.
You gotta be
so
kidding.
These answers come to me so rarely. There is disease in my hereditary.
If you visited the Desert Botanical Gardens, Hunt's Tomb, or Sandra Day O'Connor's house, then you've been in Papago Park in Phoenix and Tempe, but not Scottsdale, even though the park's northern edge is very close to the city. Scottsdale Mayor Jim Lane is interested in annexing 100 acres of the park from Phoenix. He tried once before, not long after being elected in 2009, but the effort went nowhere. Lane says he'd still like Scottsdale to have a footprint in Papago.
Really, the message was pretty simple, and there wasn't any hidden agenda on it at all. It was just simply that we would be able to work more closely with the other cities that are, you know, in the process of maintaining and enhancing Papago Park in that area. as sort of a community park, but also a tri-city kind of park. This is, it's federal land, the land we're talking about, and it's right now it's controlled by the National Guard. And we wouldn't be doing anything to change that, until which time is that where that application might change, and if they were to move. This is, I think it's BLM land that they lease now to the National Guard, and it's all within the city of Phoenix's jurisdiction, political subdivision, that we would just say that, hey, there isn't any tax consequence to this land whatsoever. So there's no give or lose here on anybody's part. And we would be partners in a collaborative effort for the entire area. And within our guidelines of our charter, we would be able to participate more fully.
Are there things in that part of Papago Park that might add to the community? Were there any ideas that were floated?
The thinking here is that Barnes Butte, which is the largest and the highest butte within the Papago Peaks, would be, I think, an excellent add to the park. And it would also give us access, I should say, to that neighborhood to the north, into the park at that point in time. Now, there's some other tactical or sort of strategic issues that might have to be determined as far as McDowell Road and some of that in allowing passage to and from, you know, the south side of the park to the north side of the park.
Marilyn, you've got an ally on the Phoenix City Council in Sal DeCicco. What has he said about why he's enthusiastic about this possibility?
I think Sal gets it. Working together collaboratively in this kind of thing, I think works to the best benefit of everybody. There is a little bit of an issue that there were some designs on true development of the area. This is 100 acres, which incorporates that butte, but it might also be subject to some kind of additional development. No one has mentioned specifically that that's what they're going to do, but it may be that they want to reserve that option, particularly when and if the National Guard area ends up potentially moving to some other location.
Scottsdale Mayor Jim Lane floating an idea he first brought up 5 years ago.
Now, some things have changed since then. New Phoenix mayor, new members on the city council, new city manager. But one thing appears to be the same, Phoenix's lack of interest in this arrangement. Lisa Takata is the city's deputy city manager.
I'm not aware of any situations where we've considered an annexation of city property to another entity. However, if there was a proposal, we certainly could look at it. We'd have to study various implications. Since it's a park's property, obviously the importance of our stewardship of a park's asset is very important. There would be a lot of different levels where we would have to have that discussion.
You mentioned that there really haven't been any discussions within the city of de-annexing part of Papago Park and letting Scottsdale take it over. Do you envision that changing at all?
Well, we certainly, I think, would be open to discussions about how the two cities work together on usage of the park. But the annexation is not something that I have any experience that the city has done before.
Phoenix Deputy City Manager Lisa Takata. It's time to head out to another of the Valley's hot corners, spots around town with a lot going on. Let's meet our tour guide.
I'm Kimber Lanning. I'm the executive director of Local First Arizona.
I met Kimber outside the Mesa Art Center at Center and Main Streets in downtown Mesa. And as you'll hear, it was a bit blustery during our conversation.
So what I love about downtown Mesa is that they have so much great building stock here. It is truly a walkable area. These sidewalks are covered, they're shaded, and they're populated with all kinds of great little businesses. So you've got the arts, you've got culture, you've got great retail, you've got cool restaurants, you've got some nightlife. There's a lot going on here.
Has it always been this way in this area?
No. In fact, little known fact about me, I lived in downtown Mesa for many, many years. And, you know, these buildings have seen a lot of vacancy in their day. And the revitalization that's occurring right now is very, very exciting. You know, there's techies down here. You're seeing all kinds of businesses, a great entrepreneurial space. And there's affordable space here. So I expect that it's going to continue to boom like this for a while to come.
Light rail is expanding into Mesa. In other parts of the Valley, we've seen that development has sort of sprung up along the line. Do you expect that to happen here?
Well, they don't have nearly the vacancy. I mean, in downtown Phoenix, we're sitting on 42% vacant land. This area in here, right through this stretch in downtown, is pretty much occupied with cool old buildings. So you're going to see a little bit of redevelopment, of course, but by and large, they're not. It's a completely apples to oranges because we don't have the vacancies out here, the vacant land that you do in downtown Phoenix.
What led to this area sort of becoming what it is now? How did that happen?
So I think it's a perfect storm. I think you have the right leadership in place. I think that the Mesa City Council gets this infill piece. They get that they want to be competitive for higher wage jobs. But I also think that entrepreneurs are looking for cool building stock on a street that is totally pedestrian friendly. And this is it. You've got downtown Phoenix. You've got downtown Tempe, downtown Scottsdale, downtown Mesa, all those downtowns. And this one, it's just the heyday of what's going on in terms of the revitalization here.
Some of these buildings are, as you said, very interesting, kind of cool old buildings, and some of them are quite old, right?
Oh, yeah. You've got buildings down here from between 1900 and 1920, 1925, for sure. And a lot of them have cool lofts up above. So there's a salon right down here where the owner and his wife live in the loft right above it. And it looks like you're in New York. It's a huge, wide-open loft with a wall of windows looking out on Main Street. And you don't see those sort of live-workspace-type buildings because that model pretty much went away in the greater Phoenix area after about 1940, and you just didn't see it. And until just recently, when people are trying to build it again, and you've got, you know, planners scratching their heads saying, well, are you commercial or residential? And you're saying, I want to be both. And there's really no line for you to get in. We're trying to change that. But that used to be the way to build, and then we got away from that for a long time.
Do you anticipate that this area, sort of what's considered downtown Mesa, the cool part of downtown Mesa, will it continue to expand, or do you think where we're at now is pretty much where we're going
to
be?
I think it's going to continue to expand in the sense that there is additional building stock. If you head east of here and if you head south, there's definitely additional areas for entrepreneurs to continue to move in. So my prediction is that it's going to continue to grow and expand.
Kimber Lanning is the executive director of Local First Arizona. We met in downtown Mesa at Center and Main Streets.
There's a quiet room with dim lights that only a handful of people have access to. It's called the Mystery Room. It's right here in Phoenix, and KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us inside.
Finding the Mystery Room requires a bit of guidance. To enter, you must have a password. Did you know a speakeasy at the Arizona Biltmore Hotel in Phoenix has reopened after 80 years?
I'll take you in the main door, but you'll see once we get inside there are quite a few so that people could escape when they needed to during Prohibition in case of a raid.
With password in hand, I walk in with the Biltmore's Sarah Moran. We're greeted by the bartender.
Hello. How are you?
Good evening. Did you catch tonight's password?
If you get confused, listen to the music play.
The speakeasy first opened in 1929. At that time, it was used as the men's smoking room. Wink, wink. Tonight, the lights are dimmed and music plays in the background. Wooden tables and chairs designed by Frank Lloyd Wright are set against a wall. An ornate fireplace adorns another wall. And about 15 feet above are small windows.
And that's where we used to have a staff member on the roof. And he would watch for the police. And as they were coming down the 6-mile dirt road, because at the time there was nothing else around this property, he would shine the light inside, and everyone would disseminate into their rooms. They'd know the police were coming.
Moran points to four doors placed throughout the room. Each one leads to what was either a sitting area or a hallway. That's where the men escaped before police arrived. She says this became known as the Mystery Room because wives and children often wondered about where the men would disappear to. After Prohibition ended in 1933, the speakeasy and the rooms behind the getaway doors were converted into office space. But just last summer, the hotel decided to bring the Mystery Room back to life.
Hello.
If you get confused, listen to the music play.
All right. Welcome.
What he said.
Every Sunday, guests arrive, give the password, and buy a cocktail. Every week, there's a new secret code. It's posted on Twitter,
or you can ask the concierge. But I suggest you get directions, because the mystery room is not easy to find. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, things we should know, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Would you spend $6,400 on a record?
This is my baby, but my mistake too. I'm a baby, and I lay me down to it. Hope that I can stand the test.
That's how much a collector paid a couple of years ago for this rare 45 by the Parliaments, a group fronted by George Clinton that eventually turned into the legendary Parliament Funkadelic.
It's the thrill of hunting for a rare find like this that drives a local record swap meet put on by a group called Rare.
Really avid record enthusiasts.
Dan Hall is one of those enthusiasts. His record collection hit about 2,000 at its peak. Lately, he's been selling off some of that vinyl at the swap meet.
It's not really about me trying to make money. It's more trying to sell them to people who also love the music and, you know, making a little bit extra money so that I can buy the records. A lot of guys will do both. They'll go to the show and they'll have a small table to sell stuff, and then they run around and buy stuff from the other dealers.
The meet's been running in its current form for more than a decade, with a year off for some construction at the building. It's back on, meeting every other month.
I'm happy that the show is still going on. I'm happy that we still have our little record show.
The Rare Record Swap Meet is tomorrow at the Arizona American Italian Club in Phoenix. A lot of stuff to do this weekend, lots of goings-on. For example, comedian Paul Reiser, I know, Steve, he's one of your favorites. I know you're a big Mad About You fan. He'll be performing at Stand Up Live downtown today and tomorrow.
Mark, I was going to declare publicly I'm mad about you, but now that you stole that from me. The Suns are hosting the Knicks tonight, and they're continuing race for the playoffs. That's at U.S. Airways Center.
Also, the McGall Mountain Music Festival takes place this weekend at Margaret T. Hance Park. It's the 11th annual festival featuring artists like Ben Harper, Charlie Musselwhite, Slightly Stupid, and many more.
I thought you were mentioning us there with Slightly Stupid.
Not this time, no.
Thanks. Also, Ultimate Play Date coming up Saturday at the Civic Center Library in Scottsdale. Family-friendly event with 8 different zones for learning and fun.
We also want to mention that the Tiny Desert Concert of the Painted Choir, there's video of it. You can see it online at our website, kjzz.org. Hear them play. It's pretty cool. kjzz.org.
The show was produced this week by Sarah Ventry, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Bruce Drummond, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. The managing editor, Al Macias, news director, Peter O'Dowd. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.